what I'm trying to do in Parliamentary Sketches is to point out the human comedy of it all. So I just find the whole thing sometimes a hoot.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That is the magazine that sponsors this show and brings it to you every week. We like to sit down with a different Christian and hear something of their life story. And I'm delighted to say that my guest on The Profile today is Quentin Letts. He is a journalist and author who has written for a number of national newspapers, including The Daily Mail, where he's worked as a parliamentary sketch writer. He's also been a theatre critic and has authored numerous books. His latest title is Nunc, a novel which promises to bring the first century Jerusalem to life. We're going to be hearing plenty more about that book, as well as Quentin's life and faith in journalism and broadcasting. So, Quentin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Sam.
Great to have you with us in the studio today. Now, I was reading that you were named Quentin because you were your parents' fifth child. Is that right?
That's correct. My father was a Latin teacher, and Quintus, Roman, Latin for fifth, and that's how I got this rather peculiar name. It has to be said, it was slightly an act of memory as well, because my parents' first child only lived a few days. So I was sort of named partly in memory of Stephen, who didn't live very long.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. And was that something that you were very aware of from an early age?
Well, it was never concealed from me, but it was never allowed. My parents never allowed it to become gloomy. When I think of it now, here I am, age 62, with three children of my own, and I think of what my parents went through. They're very young at the time. My mother's, she gave birth. She got married, rather, at 19, so she was only 20 when she had the first child. And my father had to do the funeral on his own of that, of poor Stephen. And I think about the circumstances of it, I slightly shrivel, and I feel very humble about what they must have gone through. But no, it was never a secret, and Stephen was honoured and was considered part of our family.
Mm. Tell me a bit more about life growing up. We like to sort of go back to the beginning here on the show.
Back to Genesis.
Well, yeah, not quite that far, admittedly. Was Christianity part of your upbringing?
It was. My parents ran a school, a prep school, in Cirencester, Gloucestershire, which my grandfather had run as well. And my dad used to take services in the school chapel, leading them as a lay a lay person doing the Book of Common Prayer, matins, and sometimes evensong. So I was always dragged along to the school chapel and to other churches as well.
Dragged along willingly or unwillingly?
Well, I think probably unwillingly at that stage. But it was always part of life, and Sunday was, you know, the day when people went to church. So there was never any question about that. But also singing hymns was a big part of chapel life at that school and elsewhere. I've always loved singing hymns.
What's your favourite?
I don't know. I mean, lots. One church, one faith, one God. Thy hand, O God, has guided. We had that at our wedding, and I've always loved belting that out. I am an enthusiastic but imprecise singer.
I once knew a worship leader who said, "Come on, let's be wrong and strong."
Well, that's good. A good attitude.
Yes.
And my wife is a church organist, and she despairs sometimes of the level of singing in congregations, a lot of particularly at weddings, for instance. People come along and they're not used to being in church. But she says always, if they've been in the army, they can sing. If they're Welsh, they can sing. Or if they've been at public school. And if you can get one of those three in the congregation, you're normally okay. Some sort of honker in the back will be leading everyone along.
So you said as a child, sometimes you were dragged to church unwillingly.
Well, I guess so. I mean,
presumably now it's a little bit more willingly. So what changed?
Well, one grew up, I suppose. I mean, I was never one of the sort of person who's sort of pouting and say, I'm not going to go to church. But you know, children are find sermons pretty boring, don't they? I think I still find some sermons pretty boring. But I love going to church for the routine of it, the assurance of the routine. And also for the language. I like going to prayer book services, so Cranmer is a big part of my life. And It gives you a chance to ponder things and to put your life into context, it strikes me. And sometimes you can cast aside the cares of the day and just apply your mind to higher matters, provided the liturgy is OK. I get very annoyed sometimes if I go to a service where the liturgy might jar slightly, so I try to avoid services I know I'm not going to like.
Yeah. And, I mean, you've kind of referenced this already. In your lifetime, we've arguably gone as a society from church being that very normal, routine part of life to now, for a lot of people, it's just not playing any part at all. I don't know if you'd recognise that description. And to what extent Christians should be trying to win people back? Or is this a bit of a lost cause that just our culture has changed, really, beyond all recognition, from a time where church going was very normalised to now seen as quite odd in some sectors of society?
Well, part of me says that the human rhythms and needs will reassert themselves, and that these things sometimes go in cycles. And if you look at English church going in the 18th century, 19th century, first part of it, a lot of churches were in a terrible state, certainly in our local church. In the village I live in Herefordshire, the roof was falling in. But now it's in a much better condition. And so I'm not entirely gloomy, but I do wish that I think we would be a much happier society if more people went to church, not just to church, but also to synagogue and mosque and temple. I think, I find atheism, sort of militant atheism, a very barren prospect. And I hope that that churches will rediscover their supporters. I'm not somebody who thinks that tremendous sort of muscular proselytizing is necessarily going to work. I think the way to draw people back is to say, look, this is what we do. Come along if you're curious. And also, I'd very much like to see a return to those sort of traditional liturgies. And worship as something dignified. I'm talking here about Anglican churches. I think perhaps a lot of worship has been denuded in the last 40 years. It's been stripped of its dignity and majesty. And I'd like to go. I think if churches offered a bit more of that, they might find a few more punters coming through the gates.
I'd love to go back to your early life, move it on a little bit. I understand you went to boarding school.
I did. Well, the school my parents ran was a boarding school, and I didn't want to go there. My father had been educated by his father and didn't like it much, or he'd sort of seen that there were limitations to it. So I was sent away at the age of 8, and not very far, only 40 miles away, and I was very happy at that prep school. Then I went to a public school, which was even further away. And it was always just part of the world I grew up in because my parents were in private education. So
I've spoken to a number of people who've sat in that chair, who've been to boarding school, and almost everybody I've spoken to has said that to a greater or lesser extent, it damaged them emotionally.
Didn't do that at all. And perhaps my wife would tell you otherwise. But I loved it. I found it was completely fine, and there was never any sort
I guess
of...
for some people, they just think it's such an early age to sort of leave your parents. And some people describe it as an environment of everything from bullying to sort of stiff upper lip. And I mean, you don't recognise any of that in your own life.
I do. Well, I can recognise the stiff upper lip thing. But what's wrong with that? I mean, I think perhaps we're a bit too prone to blubbing these days. Mm-hmm. I sound like a terrible old harumpha when I say things like that. But, you know, perhaps it's a sort of Protestant approach to sort of coping with your own life and getting on and addressing things yourself. But I just found that it was fine. I never, I wasn't beaten up. I wasn't interfered with, thank goodness. I know some people were, but I wasn't. And I've made some good friendships. And I also learned perhaps to stand on my own two feet a bit. But there's a limit to, I mean, one can sound very arrogant saying that. So, you know, there's a limit to how much you can stand on your own two feet. But I just got on with it.
Sure. And if I'd met you that age and said, what do you want to do when you grow up? What would you have said?
I'd have probably said I want to be a prop forward for England or a hooker. I loved playing rugby at that time, but
it wasn't to be.
Well, the blokes all got a bit too big.
What did take you into writing and journalism?
I always enjoyed it. And at prep school, when I suppose I was 11 or 12, we started a little, a member of the staff started this school magazine. And I was in the choir at the time. I was the head chorister at our school. And we went on a choir outing to Longleat, and I wrote up an account of this in the school magazine called The Elms Express. And I wrote a sloppy sentence that said the choir outing was to Longleat. Mr. and Mrs. Harland, Mr. Harland was the choir master, Mr. and Mrs. Harland came too, so there wasn't much room in the minibus. Now, this was taken very badly by Mr. Harland, who was on the plump side, God rest his soul, and I was kicked out of the choir as a result. Wow. Very unfair.
Wow.
But it was my first experience of libel, defamation. But I've always wanted, I think it was the show-off in me, but also just the, you know, the excitement of seeing one's name in print. Terrible sort of sugar rush at that. But also just to use words is fun. And to be honest, it was either that or becoming a schoolmaster. And I saw how hard my parents worked, so decided that journalism was for me.
Yes. And, I mean, you have had a remarkable career. I mean,
don't know about that. So far, I've managed to avoid being sacked, Sam. That's what you mean.
You've written for, I think, every national newspaper, almost.
Most of them, yeah. Sprayed it around.
Am I right in thinking you've said you've been writing political journalism in one form or another every week since Tony Blair was Prime Minister in 1997.
It goes back, Bill. Well, every week, yeah, since... I've been sketching every day since that day of infamy. 1st of May, 1997. But I was sketching... I started off sketching Parliament when Mrs. Thatcher was still Prime Minister.
Yes, and I was reading that some people blame you for her downfall, but it wasn't your fault.
Wasn't
I don't know if you want to explain
fault.
That. Explain.
Well,
that.
What happened was Simon Heffer, who is a very talented sketchwriter, was sketching for the Telegraph, and he went off on a sabbatical. And while he was away, a couple of us were given chances to stand in for him. And while Heff was a tremendous Thatcherite, a supporter of the Blessed Margaret, and while he was away, she was toppled, and I was sort of holding the joystick at the moment when she went. So I think he's always slightly blamed me.
We should probably just go back a step. For those who are not familiar, do you want to have a stab at describing the rather unique style of writing that is political sketch writing?
Political sketch exactly writing. Yeah, well, you're quite right, Sam, because it is a... I was going to say an art form, but it's certainly not that. It's a journalistic genre that exists only in Britain. Nowhere else do you find this strange beast, the parliamentary sketch. And what it is, it's a daily account of what happens in one of the Houses of Parliament. But it is not really a report. It is a subjective, i.e. biased, view of the personalities. And it looks at politics through the prism not of policy, but of character. So you're looking at the way that the politicians walk and talk and the way that they relate to each other off the ball, if I can put it. So I can talk about what happens behind the Speaker's chair if I see the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition chatting to one another. And you're trying to describe the theatre of Parliament, which is an important part of our politics, actually. The theatrical cockpit of Parliament is intensely interesting to me, but it's a very big part of our politics, and it's something that some politicians try to discount. And Sir Keir Starmer, perhaps, and Theresa May were of the opinion, perhaps, that it didn't matter, but my goodness, it does.
And why does it matter?
It matters for the basic reason that you have to get your parliamentary troops, the people who are going to vote for your bills, cheering you and supporting you and seeing that you have got... You've got what it takes to be party leader.
Mm. And I suppose the kind of theatre of Parliament for most people would be most obvious at something like Prime Minister's questions, PMQs.
Yeah. And everyone poo-poos. Everyone says the argy-bargy
yes.
of Prime Minister's questions is unhealthy and bad. It's not. To me, it's essential because it's a place where politicians, our ministers, are having their arguments tested. Their arguments, basically, their policies that they are imposing on us. And they're having them tested. So you're sort of putting them through the kiln. And if the policies are no good, they will crack in the kiln. But if they're OK, then they will be strengthened by that process of the argy-bargy. And it shows to me a parliament shouldn't be a place where people agree with each other. It should be a place where people disagree. And disagreement... is a cacophonous business.
Mm. What have you learnt about politics and the way our system works through so many years of doing this political sketch writing?
Heavens, I don't know. I think perhaps that ministers are not very powerful and that the really powerful people are the civil servants who occasionally come before Parliament at select committees, but also the people in the quangos and the arms-length bodies. And, you know, there's an awful lot of power exercised in this country, which is very seldom held to account.
What about the power you hold? Do you recognise that you hold power as a journalist writing these sketches or writing in general for National News? Because some people would say, wow, you're where the power is. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument. But the answer to that is, if people say it's an unhealthy power, I can have two answers to that. One is, if you don't like what I write, go and read what John Crace is saying in The Guardian, my friend John, who's the Guardian sketchwriter, because he takes normally a completely different view from what I do. And the other answer is that my readers are, if you like, my voters. And if what I'm writing is unadulterated rubbish, then they will stop reading it and I'll get the boot. So that's the answer to that. But one is, yeah, one's aware of, I hope I'm not irresponsible with it.
No. I was going to ask if there are particular challenges, and I ask this of everyone I meet, whatever job they do, you know, are there unique challenges for you doing that job as a Christian? You know, are there particular ethical things that come up that are unique to your profession in a way that wouldn't be happening if you were working in a shop or taking the bins out? You know what I mean? There's in every profession, there are sometimes ethical dilemmas. Yeah. That are unique to it. And I just wonder for you as a Christian in journalism, what those have been, if indeed there are any.
Well, first of all, do I regard myself as a Christian? I'm not sure I do. I regard myself as a churchgoer. But being a Christian, is that something I consciously sort of put on my lapel every day? I don't think it is. It's deeper than that.
In what way?
Well, it's always been part of me, I suppose. Mm. And I am not a good enough churchgoer constantly to feel fueled by the Gospels. So I'm more a sort of a Don Quixote figure, seizing my lance and galloping off madly at the horizon sometimes. But Don Quixote was a good Christian soul. The other part of your question is, you're basically asking about the truth. And journalists should try to tell the truth, be they churchgoers or not. That is part of the job description, if you like. Mm. So I hope I try to tell the truth as I discern it. Now, the actual end truth might be different from what I consider the truth. But if I'm trying my best to sort of see through what's happening in Parliament and tell my readers what's going on as I see it, then I think that an honourable pursuit is perhaps too strong a way of putting it. But it's not corrupt.
Mm. I'm really interested in what you just said about, I think you said you're not the most regular churchgoer. And
I am. I'm pretty regular. I'm a regular doctor. But I'm not. I wouldn't consider myself a holy moly.
What is a holy moly?
I don't know. Somebody who feels devout and good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm shriveled.
I don't think anyone feels good.
Shriveled by faults.
I mean, for me, the whole point of the gospel is that you're not good, and that's why you need
God. I know. But it's a very fair point. But there are some people, let's put it like this, whose chief purpose when they get up every day is to pump out Christian thoughts and
sure.
and
yeah, which is not it's not the job you have either.
It's not the job I have, but I'm.
But you know, if you effectively took over your political sketch writing and just started to write sermons every week, then you know that's not what you're employed to do, is it?
It's not. But at the same time, I hope there can be a thread of Anglican outrage sometimes.
Right.
In what I'm saying now,
yeah.
I think it's perfectly decent and proper for me as somebody who goes to church and gets down on his knees on a Sunday occasionally to explode with rage. I think that's perfectly proper.
Yeah.
Inside the context of my sort of Cranmerian pursuits, and therefore I don't see that there is a clash between occasionally being angry and saying the creed.
Well, Jesus himself, I'm sure, was pretty angry when he was turning over tables in the temple. So clearly there's a time and a place for that level of outrage.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting to sketch Jesus. The way he dealt with criticism and political challenge was very clever. He was so intellectual and good at it that he would never actually attack them and get angry with them, would he? He would sort of point out the inadequacies of their position.
I love that thought of what it would have been like to sketch Jesus. That maybe we're
sketch Pilate as well.
Maybe we're getting ever so slightly closer to your new book, Nunc.
Nunc, yeah.
Which, as I mentioned, promises to bring first century Jerusalem to life.
First century BC, basically. Yeah, this is the Nunc, as you know, Sam. This refers to the Nunc Dimittis, which is one of the canticles. Lord, now let us thou thy servant depart in peace. And this is the Song of Simeon. Simeon, the prophet Simeon, who was arguably the first Christian, because Simeon had been told by an angel to wait and wait and wait in Jerusalem at the temple until he saw the Messiah. And he was told, you will not die until then. And he waited and waited and waited. And he must have felt like a batsman playing for England, stuck on naught, until eventually this young couple from Nazareth turned up to present their infant to the temple. And it was Joseph and Mary, and Simeon lifted the infant Christ into his arms, and he realized at that moment that it was the Messiah. And so he must have had slightly conflicting emotions, because the sort of triumph of the Messiah having arrived, but at the same time realizing that this was the end for him. This was his chips were up. In a way, he was triumphant in death in the way that Christ would be. Was a great exemplar of fatalism. And it was when he lifted the child that what an extraordinary moment that must have been. And this book of mine, it's dedicated to my late sister and my late brother. My brother, Alexander, who was 4 years older than me, he had terminal cancer, and he knew for a year that he was dying. And he fought it and fought it and fought it. He was tremendously fit. He was only 60, just turned 60 when he was told he had it. Had cancer. And he fought and fought until his grandson arrived, his first grandson, and he picked up that infant. And in the moment, I've always thought, we got a photograph of the moment when he picked up the infant and held little Ludo in his arms. And it was a sort of Simeon moment. Mm. And after that, Alexander accepted his death in the most extraordinary, brave and resilient and inspiring way. And so, therefore, this book is dedicated to Alexander. The book makes it, this all makes it sound a very gloomy book. I hope it's not. There were you may remember, you may not remember, there were stories written in the 1940s, 1950s by an Italian called Giovanni Guareschi. Sounds like a footballer, but he wasn't. He was a very funny writer of little stories, Piccolo Mondo stories. And he had a character called Don Camillo. Don Camillo was a little priest in the Po Valley in rural Italy in the 1940s, who was always at war with the communist mayor. And these little stories of Giovanni Guareschi sort of illustrate the world, a wider truths of the world, through the battles between the priest, Don Camillo, and the communist mayor. And I am trying to bring the same sort of tone of Piccolo Mondo to first century BC Jerusalem, where my Simeon is living and getting on with his friends and having coffee, tea in Deuteronomy Square, and all the chaos of Jerusalem life, as this amazing man Simeon, who's going to have an amazing effect on the world. And there's also, if I can bifurcate a little bit, you'll know that there's an untold story about how did the Holy Family escape the massacre of the innocents? How did they get away from nasty King Herod? We're never told that in the Gospels, are we? And my book answers that question. I offer a solution anyway.
Fantastic.
In that I say that my friend Simeon, he feels like a friend to me. Simeon and his friends are, if you like, they're the getaway car. Yes. They provide the escape network.
It's a wonderful kind of style of writing, this kind of historical fiction, because as you point out and what you've said already, you clearly know the scriptures very well and the gospels and what we do
I
know.
Don't, I'm
and
not yet, sure I do.
You've retold the story of Simeon, at least. But what's great, of course, with the gospels is there's so much there, and yet there is so much that we just don't know that is not there. And it sounds like you're able to try and imagine and fill in some of those gaps in a way that's kind of plausible and fun and interesting. Is that the kind of aim with a book like this?
It is a book. Colm Tabin wrote a book about Mary once. I think it's called The Testament of Mary, is it? Which is a very intense and artistic and dense and fantastic book. And he really brings Mary the figure of Mary, the character of Mary, brings her out. I tried to do the same with Simeon because I looked at the story of Simeon. It's only 10 verses in St. Luke's Gospel. That's all we get about Simeon and his companion, Anna, who's the old woman of 80. And it struck me... I mean, I've always found Simeon an amazing figure, an exciting figure. In my childhood Bible, there was a very good illustration of Simeon, of that moment in the temple. And it was a sort of glamorous picture, and I was caught up with that. But I started thinking, who was Simeon? What took him there? What was his relationship with Anna? Had they been lovers at one point? Did they know one another well? And also, why was Simeon in need of salvation? So maybe there was... and so I've tried to create a backstory, a terrible expression, I know. I tried to create that for Simeon, imagine who he might have been and what his family might have been.
Hi, I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Every month, our team brings you deep, thoughtful journalism around the biggest topics affecting you as a Christian today. Our mission is to help you encounter God through the magazine. The latest issue features Switchfoot lead singer John Foreman, plus we're previewing the largest gathering of Christians ever. Find out more in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine.
It reminds me a little bit of the very popular TV show The Chosen. I don't know if you've seen any of it.
Never saw that, no.
It's a similar kind of concept of trying to, as you say, fill in some of the backstories. And the key, though, is being plausible with it. You know, and
well, the thing about writing historical fiction is that you have to do a tremendous amount of research, and being a journalist, I'm not very good at that.
You're giving our profession a bad
name. Far too much like hard work. So the whole story is...
You prefer to just make it up.
The whole story, or these little stories of mine, it's only a short novel as well, they're bookended by a modern scene of a sort of corduroy trousered Englishman who's just been told that he's dying, and he enters a cathedral. He's a bit tipsy. He enters a cathedral, and he hears the Nunc Dimittis being sung by the choir. And basically, this character is my brother. And therefore, the whole story is imagined by a modern Englishman. So I get out of any accusations of inaccuracy. You know the way that The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe starts with them in the modern era.
Mm.
Or 1940s, 50s as well, and then dips into Narnia with some of the same characters from modern life represented, sort of mirrored in Narnia. Well, that's what I'm trying to do here. And to me, one of the strongest things in life, and one of the things I often get when I go to church, is the idea of generation upon generation, the fact that the thing that you learn when you go to church, and if you use an old prayer book, sometimes I use a prayer book that was owned by one of my grandmothers, and sometimes I use one from the 1700s, which was owned by a stranger. If you turn over those onion skin pages and you look at things like the service for the burial of the dead, and you see that they've been well thumbed, you realise with a gulp that we are not the first. You know, that the terrible tribulations and sorrows and woes of life have been faced many times by many generations before. And the Jews have an expression, l'dor v'dor, which means from generation to generation, sort of cascading down. And in a way, nothing is new in life. So we all think, oh, my goodness, what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, or what's going on in Sudan or whatever is just, or Syria is too terrible, and how can anyone face this? But, it's all happened before, I'm afraid. These challenges have all been there before.
I really resonate with that as you're saying it. And I wonder if it's because of the professions that you and I do in journalism, which is so focused on news and, oh, my goodness, this big thing has happened and breaking news that. And that ability to step back and say, actually, historically, you know, this stuff has happened before, it will happen again. To get that sense of perspective sometimes, rather than being so caught up in the thick of the 24-hour news cycle, strikes me as something quite helpful for those of us who do take an interest in breaking news.
Yes, as I get older, and as one's tribulations mount up, and you realise that life isn't always going to be... happy, then you become more hardened to things, or perhaps you become less impressed by the novelty of disaster and also of breaking news. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you get older, you think, oh, gosh, it's happening again.
Right.
Here we go again.
I wonder, I'm going to try and tread on a hot potato here, but I know you won't mind, Quentin, because you've written about plenty of these issues. I wonder if that brings us to climate change. And I wanted to ask you about this because I was reading that you once went on the BBC, and I don't know if you would accept this, but it was reported you said something that was climate sceptical. Let's put it that way. So sceptical about climate change. And I was reading that the BBC never repeated that programme.
They wiped it.
And were embarrassed.
It was exterminated. It wasn't really my fault. Peter Lilly. I was talking to Peter Lilly. I was interviewing him, Lord Lilly. And we laughed at one point about something that Lilly had said, and it wasn't sufficiently reverential of climate change orthodoxy, and I got wiped.
So the reason this came to mind is what you just said about you kind of being, you know, as you get older, you think we've been here before.
Yeah.
And I've long held a bit of a theory, and this is not a commentary on the rights and wrongs of climate change. It's more an observation. Those of, if I may, a slightly older generation tend to be slightly more climate sceptical. And I've wondered if that is because you can remember a time where there were predictions about there being an ice age, which never came true. And other
which my dad completely believed.
Right. Is that what's going on? Is it that you're thinking, I'm a bit sceptical about some of the more recent climate change stuff because I've kind of been here before. I've seen these headlines before about ice ages and all the rest of it. And there's just a bit of, this doesn't quite ring true. Is that what's going on?
You're trying to get me into trouble.
I'm not. It's a genuine question.
You're a very naughty man. I am not sufficiently good at science to discount the testament of all these hordes of scientists. However, Michael Winner's character in those adverts, I just sometimes wish somebody would say, calm down, dear, because the frenzy of worry is becoming too much. I think, I remember when I was little, I used to have a recurring nightmare. And the recurring nightmare was sitting at a cafe table and of a nuclear bomb going off. And I had this nightmare from sort of 5 till 12, ages 5 till 12. And that was because, as a youngster, I had listened to all this stuff. At that time, everyone was talking about how there was going to be a nuclear holocaust and we were unlikely ever to get to 1984. And, you know, happily, we have made it so far, despite the worst efforts of some international politicians. So maybe just sometimes we need to be less catastrophizing about it.
Yeah. So you don't believe the predictions that unless we stop carbon emissions very, very quickly, we are heading for irreparable damage on the planet?
Well, I'm sceptical about everything. You know, I'm including faith. I mean, one needs to be sceptical in order to test arguments, but also, I think, to stay sane. In the case of the climate change stuff.
Mm.
Otherwise, you just become like one of those old men you used to see standing on the streets of Stroud, brandishing one of the Gospels and declaring that the end of the world was nigh. I mean, you know, I used to want to go up to him and say, cheer up, mate.
I often think, all that said, though, do you not think part of your role, and certainly when people write columns, part of the role is to challenge and provoke and to sometimes use language that is quite reactionary or can appear very forthright.
I try to see, actually, what I'm trying to do in Parliamentary Sketches is to point out the human comedy of it all. And so when, for instance, the government backbenchers stand up and start all shouting at the opposition backbenchers, you know, you just look at they're just being eejits. And or they're sometimes making fools of themselves, or also they're performing to certain stereotypes and caricatures. And so I just find the whole thing sometimes a hoot, and you try to point that out. And if you point out to politicians that they're being comical, they get very, very cross.
Do you have any regrets over anything you've written?
Oh, sure, quite often. And there was one. I mean, for instance, there was one time when I was sketching a TUC conference down in Brighton, and I talked about there was an elderly woman on the platform who was wearing a slightly mad-looking hat, and I took the mickey out of that, and then afterwards I discovered that the reason she was wearing a hat was that she'd been having chemotherapy and her hair had fallen out, so I felt a proper worm after that and wrote her a letter, which I hope she received before she died. So, I mean, you know, things go wrong. Sure, yeah. Journalism, things go wrong. But I hope on the whole, on the balance, and, you know, I can find an answer to things, you know, excuse myself.
Mm, sure. Yes. And I suppose it goes back to my question earlier about the very unique challenges of doing parliamentary sketch writing, and also, I mean, I know you say you don't like the term Christian, but let's say, okay,
no, I don't mind it. I'm just not sure I've earned it.
as a great way of thinking about it. But nevertheless, you're someone who goes to church, who wants to do the right thing, and yet, your job necessitates making some very pointed criticisms and using sometimes some fairly strong language to take the mickey out of people. Is there a conflict in that, or am I just being too squeamish about it?
Well, I think there might well be, yes. But, you know, we talk about the church militant. The church doesn't always have to be...
A pushover
or comradely, must it? I mean, it must occasionally take on things that it thinks are wrong. Mm. And therefore, I mean, I would certainly not claim to be always working in doing God's work. And sometimes it's far from that. But I hope that it's, you know, one can criticise within a Christian life.
Yeah. I was thinking about the time you wrote about, I think the phrase was whiny Scottish accents in a play. And I think understandably the Scottish actors sort of took exception to that. You know, what do you think of something like that? Is that just, well, that's par for the course, that was my honest opinion? Or do you think actually maybe I pushed it too far?
No, I think that was all right. I think that's what they sound like to me. Sometimes we become so tormented by political correctness that people are reluctant to write plain truths and, you know, c'est la vie. Yeah. I mean, they're just as rude about my stupid accent. You know, they give as good as they get, don't they? Go to Soshi Hall Street on a Friday night and try using the Queen's English, and you soon get put right.
I suppose some of this goes back to some of the debates we've seen recently around free speech. I mean, the most recent example I can think of is this issue of abortion buffer zones, that it's now not possible to pray within a certain distance of an abortion centre, and if you do, the police can arrest you. And there's been a couple of very high-profile cases of this law being tested in the courts recently, and you have those who are pro-life activists saying this is actually going against not only our free speech but our religious beliefs. I mean, what do you think? Is there truth in that claim? Do you think this is a law that needs looking at again?
I think it's most improper if the authorities are claiming to know what people are praying. I don't think it's any of their business, and I think it's a gross intrusion on our freedom. And I also, but at the same time, I hope that, and I am very uneasy about abortion, very uneasy. But I hope that those of us who are uneasy about abortion at the same time are kind towards, is kind the word? I don't know. I just hope we're merciful towards people who have been through abortions, or people whose sisters or mothers have been through abortions. You know, it doesn't help things if we are really sort of bitter and twisted about it. I hope we sort of just find the words to differ, but not to condemn. I'm not very keen on us condemning other people's positions on this. Mm. It's very tricky.
I mean, the other thing related to that is you would have seen J.D. Vance's comments on this issue, and it's been taken up by parts of the American political right to really argue that, well, look at this example of buffer zones in the UK. They don't have free speech anymore, which to me seems like you're maybe pushing the argument a little bit too far there. Do you see what I mean? It's been used to kind of paint in very broad brushstrokes about, look at the state the UK is in.
I heard that speech. I watched some of it, the speech by Mr. Vance at the Munich Security Conference. And I thought, oh, I think he's on to something here, because he's talking about the West. And if you're going to be the West, if you're going to defend the West, if you're going to have NATO defending the West, you've got to have something that you are defending. So you've got to have an idea of liberalism and of freedom. And I thought, that's a fair point. But then the same J.D. Vance seems to be supporting Mr. Putin against the Ukrainians. And where's the freedom of speech in that? And so I will take no lessons from Matey Vance about freedom, thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the ARC conference, which took place here in London a number of weeks ago. And for those who aren't aware, this was a political conference drawing in lots of people from the more right or centre-right of politics in both the UK and the US. And what was fascinating about that conference, from my perspective, was it was a political conference. And yet, it felt like almost every other speaker was jumping in with some very overtly Christian ideas, and you had even a number of Christian apologists on stage, quite literally next to people like Nigel Farage or Jordan Peterson and others. And that's been tracking alongside a movement that some people have argued that we're in a bit of a new era when it comes to politics and religion. We've moved a long way from the days of Alistair Campbell saying we don't do God, and you now have whatever you think of ARC, you now have a political conference where Christian and religious and churchy ideas are sitting alongside political ones. And I just wanted to get your take on that as somebody who, you know, straddles those two worlds. Do you think we're going into a new era which is no longer quite so afraid or squeamish about bringing God into political questions?
We probably are, but at the same time, I personally found Donald Trump's first his inauguration speech, where he claimed to have been sent by God, that was a bit gamey for me, I must say. If somebody's been sent by God, let us be the judge of that. Let the person himself not claim it.
Slightly messianic, isn't it?
Well, I thought it was completely self-absorbed. And
I suppose there's a...
To give
Trump his credit, there's a sense in which anyone could say that, in the sense that, well, we all believe that God created us and God has a purpose for us, and there's nothing wrong in saying that, to be fair to Trump. But clearly you're uncomfortable with it.
I thought he was just being big-headed. And I don't think he particularly has been sent by the Almighty. He's there, you know. Anyway, but going back to what you were saying, the thing about Christianity, surely, is that it was always fantastically political. And the whole of the New Testament is political, in that this description of a peace-loving rabbi, as Jesus was, I think we can say, standing up and saying what he said, the Sermon on the Mount, is a very political speech. It was revolutionary stuff, radical stuff. And the whole reason Christianity has worked and was taken up so much was that there was this political vacuum there. There was a need for kindness. There was a need for mercy. There was a need for equality in the whole of the world, but particularly in the Middle East, I think. And there still is. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with politicians being driven by, fueled by God of either side. I mean, you're right to say it used to be the case that the left was more instantly recognisable as churchy. People like Frank Field, very strong Anglican core. But now things have changed a bit, and the left seems to have regard Christianity as somehow hierarchical. Now, that's an offence to their creed, their different new creed of egalitarianism. To me, the creed of egalitarianism is not interchangeable with the creed of Christianity. In Christianity, I think it's perfectly capable for there to be hierarchies. And indeed, you know, it's capable in the Church of England, even with bishops and archbishops. And that, to me, a hierarchy can be a benevolent, enabling thing. It can be aspirational. And without a hierarchy, without that ladder, you will not have people making the most of themselves. So that's where I would disagree. That's why I'm not of the left. But I don't think that lefties can't be religious.
Yes.
Goodness me.
I think that's an important distinction, isn't it? Because one of the critiques of something like ARC, the event that I mentioned, is that it was very, very right of centre, and this particular most recent conference wasn't much input from the left. And I suppose what you're saying is, well, you personally identify more with the right, but you would never want to make out that if you're a follower of Jesus, your only option is to be politically right of centre. But that's what
I mean. Hang on, because in a way, Christianity is very socialist in its message of equality and of decency, and you know, the Good Samaritan would probably have been a member of the Fabians rather than of the Monday Club. So you know, there are all sorts of contradictions, aren't there, in all this? But at the moment, I think it's certainly the stigma of Christianity in politics has disappeared a bit. And I think when Alistair Campbell was saying that, I mean, I'm never be the first person to defend Alistair. But I think he was basically saying, you know, look, Tony's faith is a personal thing. But we're not, you know, we're not doing this in the name of God. We're doing it because we think it makes good political sense and because these are good policies. Mm. So I hope that's what he was saying. I think it was.
Occasionally I meet Christians who say these politicians, they're all as bad as each other.
Everyone
can't
says that.
Can't be doing with it. I'm not politically engaged. I'm probably not going to vote. You know, we'll have to wait for Jesus to come back and sort them all out. And just not interested at all. Would you try and convince a Christian who thinks that way to be a little bit more engaged? And if so, how would you go about it?
Well, I'd say to them, well, if you don't have parliamentarians, who is going to be running the show? So unless you want a bunch of armless lifters and goose steppers marching down Whitehall, I think probably the parliamentary system is preferable to that. So I would say, yeah, you know, politicians can drive us round the bend. But, you know, the alternative is less attractive. And if you feel strongly about it, then, you know, stand for office. Have a go. You know, next time there's a vacancy on the parish council,
it's so much easier. But it's so much easier to open Twitter and have a moan than it is to actually go and stand to run to be an MP, isn't it?
It is.
Or dare I say, write some copy, and that's on
pelting people with cabbages.
It's on both of us as well. You know, it's easier for me to write an opinion piece about how terrible it all is than actually go out and make a difference. So that's probably a challenge to all of us, isn't it?
The thing though strikes me about the world as it is at the moment is that we are a Protestant nation, and the Protestants, or we were a Protestant nation, and the nation bestowed to us by Oliver Cromwell, and then there was the monarchy came back. It was very much a nation of individualists, and the Brits are highly opinionated, bloody-minded people. They are not averse to telling you exactly what they think. And I think that's a good thing. And if people are saying, well, I can't be bothered with those politicians, they are actually expressing an opinion. They are, sorry, but that is a political position you're taking. And, you know, hooray, let the frustration bubble forth. Let it come, you know, geezering out of the gutters. Because that is much better than things being suppressed, as happened, say, behind the Iron Curtain, you know, when people weren't allowed to have an opinion. It happens still, I'm afraid, behind China, in China. So, you know, it's much better for this rage to boil forth.
Mm. And another question on the wider kind of cultural moment we're in. I sometimes hear that there is a media bubble or a political bubble, perhaps especially those of us currently sitting here in London, where some views are deemed just way too controversial, and the London sort of liberal bubble of the media political elite, they don't countenance these opinions, they think they're backwards. But in reality, millions of people outside of the London media bubble believe these things, and perhaps we've touched on one already about climate scepticism, for example. I think they've been called luxury beliefs as well. Have you come across that idea? And do you think there's any truth in it? That actually there's some areas that the quote-unquote average, normal, everyday person who isn't a lefty London liberal believe, and sometimes their views, they're just not properly represented in a place like Parliament?
Yeah, I think that's undoubtedly true. And it's undoubtedly true about climate change. It's undoubtedly true at the moment about the Chagos Isles, hoo-ha. And it's true possibly about it is true about immigration, I'm sure. You know, polite opinion has always been with us, hasn't it? I'm sure that if you had been in Parliament in the 1700s, then there would have been things equally that would not have been said. There's always been a sort of self censorship button.
Do you feel that as a writer, that you're
Well, less so on the Daily Mail than I would perhaps writing elsewhere, I think. But, you know, you...
But it's still there.
Well, is it? No, sure, on the Mail, actually. I think I can pretty much write what I think. But do I have... I mean, I take, for instance, one thing that I am probably blind on, which I know some people feel very strongly about, is gypsies, the Roma. And... I was actually asked about this once when I was being courted by a tabloid newspaper, a Red Top. They wanted me to write for them, and they said, what do you feel about the gypsies? And I had to confess, I did not feel strongly about it, because where I live, it's just not a problem. So that, I mean, you can only feel strongly about things if you've been exposed to them. I think probably this is true, isn't it?
Mm.
By and large. And if you haven't been exposed to them, you probably don't comprehend quite how bad it is. So if you are a politician living in Islington, you possibly don't understand how people feel in Kent, where their local schools and doctors and surgeries are being overwhelmed by new arrivals. If you are, in the bubble, you don't. Your life experiences, your lived experiences, and that's what we have to say these days, is just not up to it. So not up to encompassing everything. So that's why good politicians are good listeners, and they listen to and they gauge how serious a problem is by how much they're getting in their ear.
And presumably, the constituency system where we have people in Westminster from all over the country should take care of this issue, shouldn't it? So I've just outlined the problem, which arguably there's these things that, you know, we can't talk about because we can't go there. Well, actually, in reality, if you have an MP from, say, the north of England who's in and amongst those local people and understands their views, they should then be able to represent them in a place like Westminster.
They should be able to, but you are forgetting, Sam, there's something called the whipping system. And the whips are a very unhealthy presence at Westminster. The whips are the government ministers who, and they have their counterparts in the opposition parties as well, who weirdly are given government money to do their jobs. And the whips exist to stop backbenchers expressing their views. They say, no, you can't say that because you've got to be loyal to the leadership. This is a terribly self-destructive thing. And when you get whips saying you can't mention something, it is so unhealthy because it prevents the leadership hearing that opinion. And, I mean, I was struck the other day when Sir Keir Starmer cut back on international aid. Now, my personal view of international aid is a lot of the money gets wasted, and I think a lot of people are trying it on. But a lot of Labour MPs felt very strongly that this was a bad decision by the government, but they did not say so in the House of Commons. Mm. And to me, I just can't see the point in becoming an elected Member of Parliament and not saying what you think. One or two very honourable exceptions who stood up and said, this is a rotten decision, we don't like it. But Sir Keir Starmer will only be able to make informed decisions if people are getting in his ear about
it. And is the reason those MPs don't say anything is because they want to, quote-unquote, progress in their career, become a minister one day?
Ambition. And the terrible sad thing is that the whips actually have a much higher regard for rebels. They think that's a proper person. He's a good lad, or she's a good sort, because they just regard the people who do their bidding as low life, pond life.
What's been the best day of your career, and what's been the worst?
Good heavens! What a difficult question. One of the most memorable days of my life in work. I should, of course, say that in personal life, it was the day I got married to my beautiful wife.
Nicely saved. That was close.
I just started being a sketchwriter, and Sir Geoffrey Howe made that speech attacking Mrs. Thatcher. And my goodness, that was a memorable scene. And I remember, as it ended, Michael Heseltine was sitting down on the awkward Scott bench, and as Howe finished, and as that session ended, Heseltine stood up, leonine figure with his long hair and very long legs and beautiful suit he wore. And he stood up, and about 10 of his henchmen stood up a second later, and they all swept out of the chamber. And you could sense that he knew, right, I'm on manoeuvres now. I'm going to try and become the Prime Minister. So that was a fantastic day. What was the worst day? I don't know. The worst time, I thought, was after the Grenfell fire. And I just got a feeling that that awful the loss of life, and there was a political system that was quite incapable of responding to that or putting it right. And the House of Commons felt a very powerless place that day. And Theresa May, she did her best, poor old goat, but, it was just a moment when things seemed to be running away from our elected system.
Mm, yes. Brexit, has it been a success?
I think it has. I'm boiling Brexiteer. I love it.
What's been successful? Because some people would say, hang on, the economy's not been a success. And hang on, we thought Brexit was going to solve the issue of immigration, but it hasn't stopped small boats, it hasn't stopped illegal immigration. So how has it been a success?
Because it's given us back our sovereignty. And a parliament means nothing if the parliament is not actually able to pass laws and do what it wants and actually be accountable for the money that it's raising. And what we used to have was a parliament that was basically acting as a proxy for Brussels. And so we've now got our own parliament. Well, it's up to the parliamentarians what they do with it. And the economy question, I think, you can argue the toss on that a bit. The immigration problem, it strikes me, is complete lack of willpower by our elite. But we have now at least got a system where we can, if we vote for them, then the people we elect could put things right. And that could is a very big word.
It is indeed. So, as I mentioned, Nunc is out now and available wherever good books are sold. And we can, of course, read your work very regularly in the Daily Mail as well. What does the future hold for you? How many...
Retirement!
When's... Dare I ask when? It also strikes me, Quentin, you're having far too much fun to talk about retirement, aren't you?
Oh, I long to retire.
Do you?
I am so knackered.
You strike me as full of energy. But
My wife keeps spending all the money. I don't know. What does await us all? I don't know. And you know, it goes back to the old thing, doesn't it, of generation to generation. This is a question been faced by everyone before. And there's the old saying, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. I don't know, you just have to keep on hoping that, you know, you're going to have good health and that the family will be all right. Mm. I don't know what to do. I'd love to be able to retire and watch cricket and read books, do a bit of gardening, go on travel, go skiing. And, you know, just have a sherry at lunch. That's my idea of heaven.
We were talking on the way in about a time you will remember and I definitely don't. But there are tales of the quote-unquote good old days on Fleet Street of all the newspaper editors and journalists going for some very long and boozy lunches. Was it really like that?
It was like that. And I was a gossip column writer at the time, a diary writer. And I was frontline Freddy as far as with lunchtime drinking goes. And... even though I now long to have retired to a comfortable chair and have a glass of chilled Fino at lunch, in those days it was rather more. It was a bottle of wine each at lunch, and it was ruinously expensive. To one's health and one's waistline. Gosh, I'm even fatter than I am now. And the inability to stay awake in the afternoon, it was exhausting, and actually drove some people to early deaths, and it was not very good. It's a much more healthy Fleet Street now, but it's a less well-informed Fleet Street. It's a less mischievous place.
Interesting.
It's a bit less fun. So
presumably a bit more productive as well, though.
Yeah, but a lot of journalistic...
I mean, the pressure now on a journalist these days to turn out stories is because of the advent of the internet is far what it used to be, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is for a lot of them. I just have to do my 666 words a day. 666, mark of the devil. That's my daily...
I feel like you've just gifted your critics a
contribution.
Line there.
I choose my word length, and I've always been happy with that one. But it all comes down, doesn't it, in the end, Sam? It comes down to this old thing of l'ador v'ador, the generation to generation. And I think, I'll tell you the reason one of the reasons I go to church, particularly at Easter as well, is that moment in St. John's Gospel when Mary Magdalene is in the garden, finds the discarded napkin and the empty tomb. And then a man says to her, Mary, and she turns around and says, Rabboni. You know, an extraordinary moment. It as I was saying that, it made my neck tingle. And the reason it makes my neck tingle is not just of the extraordinary truth of that moment, but it's also because I remember my father reading that lesson. My father read that lesson in church every year. And I can still hear his voice saying those exact words from the authorized version. That sort of immediately throws me into the pool of generational memory. And so if you ask me what is my hope for the future, my hope for the future is that my children might have a few similar memories about me and that their children, if God is ever good enough to give them children, this process, this human process, will continue of memory and experience and of learning from our elders and of the generations, our forefathers forever.
Amen. Lovely place to leave it. Quentin Letts, thank you very much for coming in.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.